Take me through stage by stage. So,
as I finished, I was now a journeyman,
compositor.
I went to the independent newspapers.
That was your next stage, yes.
Now, in 1952, I became a teacher. Got a job in Bolton Street School of Printing, the Bolton Street College.
And you were teaching in Bolton Street?
Yes.
And the department you were working in there was the printing department.
The School of Printing, yes. Yeah.
And all of that was changing. You were there. It wasn't changing in the 50s, but slowly it was coming in, wasn't it?
It was slowly coming in, but very slowly. The syllabus was very, very archaic, which is why when I got the opportunity, I was 69, when Anchor was more or less formed, as I said, I applied and got a job there, and I moved over, still with printing industry.
And from, say, 1950, how long were you in Bolton Street then?
From 1952 to 1969, I think. About 13 years, 13, 14 years.
It was a good long
time. Oh, yes, yeah.
And in all that time, what was the biggest change you saw there?
The biggest change was the development of the college as a whole. It had been an architecture, engineering and printing. And it also had at Day Junior, the ordinary technical school curriculum, you know, where they as a small text. They also had a group of those. But the other groups grew in importance. And eventually they managed to, like the cuckoo, they managed to eject apprenticeship courses out of Bolton Street College across to Linenhall Street. But I was gone by then. But the printing they kept in the college, because it was also a nice showpiece when people came around, being cynical, it was.
Yeah, I can imagine so. But were you making that decision at that time? Yeah. Was it a hard thing to do?
No, because I was having difficulties in teaching a curriculum that was archaic. I had no opportunity to upgrade or change it. And I was teaching stuff that was a little more advanced than when Gutenberg was using, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. There's that little change, you know. But the thing was changing totally. I was getting bored stiff with the same old curriculum. So when the opportunity to go to Anchor arose, I went.
And how did that arise?
I just an ad in the paper.
And off you went?
Off I went.
What was the first thing you did when you went into Anchor again, when you went back?
I set down the curriculum that for all the general trades in the printing industry, what they should be taught. As a partner from the Department of Education curriculum, but what they should be taught, the basic things that they should be taught as apprentices and how to go about doing it.
So you wrote that up?
I did, yeah, for the printing trades.
That's interesting. And then you followed
went
that
out
up
then around the country.
Yeah, as you were saying.
To persuade them.
Yeah.
With massive success, but with great support from the printing unions.
Yeah.
Who were supportive of it, you know.
Yeah. My goodness, yeah. And how many years did you keep that up?
From 69 till 88.
Mm-hmm. So again, that was the biggest part of your life in working with there.
Yeah, I mean, I retired then at 69. At, what was it? 88, yeah. 88. I was 65, yeah.
And to go back for one moment, because when you were living out here, did you know, you were connected to and you were familiar with other writers and artists. I'm just thinking of Vera Brennan.
Oh, Maeve.
Maeve, yes, Brennan, is that her name?
She was my cousin.
Yeah. Was Maeve your cousin?
She was.
I heard that she camped out at the bottom of your garden.
There's where she was.
See that little place there?
That's where she
camped in there.
We had I had an invalid brother. He had a rheumatoid arthritis, but just suffice to say that he was in the, he was a civil servant. He was at the embassy in Washington, where he hoped he was going to get great cure for his arthritis, but it didn't. He came home in a wheelchair, and he came to live with us, and then we built that place out there for him. And he happened to be in Kappa, having hands fixed or something, when Maeve was over from America. And she stayed out there. And her mother and my father were sister and brother.
All right. So so Maeve became quite well known
She did, and she didn't. When she was really at her writing for the New Yorker and such like, she was unheard of. I mean, we knew she was there, but she was unheard of over here. She was very, very well known there, but nobody ever heard about her. And then after her death, I was in touch with her brother, who lived in Florida, and I was in touch with him. He was blind, but he used to send me tapes, and I sent him tapes. And he told me about Maeve, and her nerves were very bad, and she went quite peculiar. I suppose it's like a lot of people, dementia, whatever it is now. But she was in a home, and at the time that Roddy won the Booker Prize, my cousin would really wanted her to know. He thought, oh, if he could only tell this to Maeve, because Maeve would have remembered him as a little boy. But she didn't. She'd no memory of him. He phoned her up and tried to explain who it was, but she'd no memory of him altogether. She just, her mind was gone. But it did. They did say in a few papers here that she died in poverty. She didn't. She died in a comfortable nursing home. It was, what's his name, Fintan O'Toole, who rediscovered her on a trip to New York.
It was very sad that, that she didn't actually get a chance to have experienced Roddy's success.
Oh, she'd have loved have it.
Enjoyed. She would have enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And she was a lovely woman.
And do you mind me asking, I would be really interested to know, did you see that Roddy, when he was growing up, would have... that the talent was beginning to grow?
Not at all.
Not a trace of it.
He was a quiet boy, enjoyed life, was no good at football, the same as myself. Wanted to be, though. Wanted to be Chelsea. was his wonderland, Chelsea, but he couldn't kick a ball any more than I could. But he did grow up. You see, this place was very, very rural. The fields opposite were just farms.
Farmland.
And he was growing up. But no sign at all.
Right.
Not the teentiest bit.
But grew up in the countryside. And where did the inspiration come from?
No idea.
I say his genes. It's in his genes and his... probably inspired by the fact that he had books all around him.
Was this a great book house?
Full of books. That's only a portion of them.
Books as well. The whole place is packed with books.
And you both love books, do you?
Oh, we're both great book people.
Yeah.
It might very well be that.
Also, I'm just thinking of your work and in the printing. You know, kind of has to do with papers and
that's
publishing
right.
And that. And your background as well.
Tis to a degree. I think that's why my father took to Rory so quickly when I brought him home, because he was doing Times. He used to do the Sunday Times crossword. He was a rather shy man. But Rory came in, and all he could think of saying that he couldn't work out two clues, I think it was. And Rory... as he said, the Holy Ghost hit him.
Oh, it's very, but very he worked. I very believe
he worked at two that's shoes.
It. So was his. So
and
was
he was elected.
It comes his.
And then when he discovered he was a printer, and he worked in the Echo.
And that was it.
Oh, that was enough.
As made.
I think he smelled the ink off him, and he was happy.
To go back to the time when you were you know, in Angkor, because that was a long time that you saw certainly things changing there too.
Yes.
And would you have given direction to people coming up? Would you have seen? You would have seen the way that newspapers were being printed and the changes there.
Oh yes, it was constant, because as part of the job in Angkor was verifying training courses to get grants from Brussels for the change over to new technology, and Brussels liked our paperwork. I got a tip that they like good paperwork in Brussels. And as we sat down with each of the companies that would be applying for grants, we made them follow the formula. Some said, oh, that's a lot of credibility, you know. Do you want the money? Well, then, this is the way you apply. And the result is we got plenty of money. The Cork Examiner got it, the Irish Times got it, the Irish Independent, and various other printers after that.
As a result of proper...
Proper supervision for the training course that they were prepared to undertake for new technology. As the new machines came in, electronic as distinct from mechanical, required training. And they took very well.
And acquired funding as well. So that funding wasn't actually coming from the government as such, it was coming from Brussels.
Brussels loved it.
Why was there that relationship between Brussels and us?
Because we were doing things the way we had a man, he's an old friend of mine, who has had connections with the Brussels thing, and he said, look, they love paperwork. They love it set down so and so. So we worked out how to present our plans, and they're having so much trouble all over France and Germany, and people say, no, we won't. That here were people almost in their own image, as they thought, and it looked very favourably on us. They were delighted with us.
And did you find that, you know, getting this, that the papers changed very quickly? You know, they changed from one system to another?
Well, it was almost immediate. When once they decided, once it was decided, well, out went the linotypes and all of those. Out went the printing presses, in came the new ones, the new lithographic.
That's right.
Machines.
And so when you go from that linopress that you're talking about,
the linotype
type, that was a skill there, though. I mean, to do that kind of work, there was a bit that you really had to learn it.
Yes, you had, because up to the time the late 1890s or so, typesetting was done almost exactly as it was in Gutenberg's day, 500 years before. And then this came along a mechanical way. Now, that was a huge change and huge skills, because the newspapers were still being set up by compositors by hand from the type cases at a rate of 1,000 pieces an hour corrected, you know. And here was this yoke, as they called it, could turn them out like that on a bar. That was a huge change. Well, now, then this one was transferring that onto a new keyboard, but coming out from electronically. It's huge.
It also cut down on staff.
Yes, it did.
And
5,000 people lost their jobs in London. Penn Maxwell... It wasn't Maxwell, it was the Australian man.
Murdoch.
Yeah. Like that overnight.
Yeah, yeah.
That job.
And so you probably saw this coming here too, that a lot of lads would lose their jobs.
They didn't lose their jobs here, because he worked out a proper way of doing it. There were negotiated ways of doing it, and there'd be no redundancies. And secondly, there'll be very few people taken on until these were done. And there wouldn't be replacements, but no redundancies. And it worked out perfectly.
And so when it came to to retirement stage then in the 1980s. Did you want to do something after that, or was that it?
I've been working all my life, of course not. I got a pension. I got a pension for which I'd paid 5% or 6% for quite a long time, and got the pension, which is, by the way, is now causing the pensions officers in Foss. I meet him. He's quite worried. I've been drawing the pension for 22 years. And he worries that I'm a terrible drag on his pension. And what he said,
would you have any observation as you know when you look back at over the printing world? Do you see any ways that you know changes could be made, or do you see any difference in?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't dream of even considering it now. When I pick up that newspaper. Mm. It's a marvel.
Yeah.
Look at the pictures.
That's right.
Yeah. Pictures. It used to take months, say the best part of a month, to get the plates, four plates, to make a picture like that.
That's right. Yeah, no, something like that. It was different pressing right. colours.
That's
yeah.
right. And they were all dots. You could see the dots. Count
yeah.
the dots.
Yeah.
Coarse for newspapers, finer for finer paper. But now that's coarse paper as you can get.
Mm-hmm. And would the typesetting, the quality of the typesetting, be better today than it was long in your time?
No, the quality is as good, but there was an in between phase when the first electronic machines came out. Where engineers are making them, were mm-hmm. doing everything, and the typefaces were dire. Mm-hmm. But they got the message. And they're excellent typefaces now. Even these laptops, they're really excellent now. That's my critical eye, yeah. And I'll say have a critical eye on them. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
I spot a bad font like that. You know.
Yes. You know? Yeah. And so you would have seen that kind of grey period.
That's right. Yeah.
Between the two.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.